So we're here with who?
Documentally.
And Geo Geller, and we're causing mischief in the New Yorker Hotel on 34th Street and 7th Avenue, 8th Avenue.
8th Avenue.
In Manhattan.
And it's great
and
to
you
see
just
you.
Came. Yeah,
I came in from the wet. You were here already in the warm.
Right. Well, I've been in the womb all my life.
The warm, not the womb.
Oh, I get them mixed up. You know, sometimes the womb and the warm have a very similar metaphor. And room. Room, womb, yeah. Tomb.
My room here isn't much bigger than a womb, to be honest.
It's more like a tomb. You know, these places, they don't really give you very much.
I joked this morning that Nikola Tesla actually died in this hotel.
He spent
10 years and he died in this hotel. There's a plaque somewhere. And I'm thinking, well, he didn't die in my room because there's not enough room to fall over.
Oh, right. You know, you might be onto something there. That, you know, there are places.
Well, so many celebrities die in the bath. You can stretch out.
Right. But there are places in Japan where they just have little cubby holes and they crawl into like, and it's like a beehive where they go into this little cubicle, no bigger than a bed, and no higher than, I don't know, I've seen pictures of them. I've never had the...
We've got a couple in London now. They're like pods. You could just literally slide in. It's like a big washing machine that doesn't rotate.
I've slept in and lived actually in caves in Granada, Spain. And it's interesting because the different places you sleep and live in is the different places you dream differently. So I dreamt completely different. And it's interesting living in a cave for a few months. What happens is not only are your dreams different, but it's warm in the winter and cool in the summer because you're in the heart of a mountain.
That's right. I remember spending some time in a cave in... the Cappadocian Valleys in Turkey, where they not far from Ephesus, but unbelievable places, unbelievable. The reason why I wanted to grab you on audio for a moment is because I have this faded kind of memory of you talking about your involvement with stonewashed jeans, because I was looking for a pair of kind of raw denim while I'm here, and I'm thinking, hang on a second, doesn't Geo have some historical connection with denim?
Yeah, I actually have a interesting connection. I was involved in the sandblasting industry in another lifetime before I had gray hair. Or maybe I've always had. I think I was born with gray hair. But neither nor, or more or less, to be more precise or less precise, I got into the sandblasting because I saw a potential of using sand under pressure as a carving tool. And so I thought I would get into the sign industry. And then I got this humongous compressor, which was the size of the large caterpillars.
You know, really?
Yeah, it was at the time it was a 900 CFM diesel caterpillar compressor, which they upped the RPMs to make it a 1200. That's what they sell. That's what they do. They up the RPMs to get it looking more, and then it burns your machine out faster, so you have to buy a new one. So I had this humongous machine, and I was doing I was bidding on offshore platforms, and I was doing industrial, you know, because the whole concept and reason you need to understand that is that when you're sandblasting, it's like a difference between a shovel and a backhoe. But most people don't understand that, not even the people who were consulting with the U.S. government. They were looking at equipment death. You know, I mean, how long will a piece of equipment live? And the longer it lives, that's how, doesn't matter.
That's where the investment goes.
Right. So they were using these really pinhole types of sandblasting, and I was using like a half a dollar. You know, so and so I was able to cover a lot of area. And so one day I was sandblasting a huge Alaskan crab ship boat.
As you do.
As I did. And I sandblasted my pants with this. And so I got this little hole in my jeans, right? It didn't go through the jeans, but I felt softer. I said, wow, there must be something. So fast forward another lifetime, a couple of other lifetimes, a couple of divorces, marriages, I can't remember them. You know, they get them mixed up. And I wound up at a textile show in L.A. I didn't know what I was doing, but I had this square inch of fabric. And I took it around to some of the guys, and there was DuPont, which makes a lot of the Lycra for expandable, jeans, so that way they'll fit anybody. But most jeans at that time were all cotton, and there was a very small percentage of jeans that were made out of a synthetic blend. So he said, "You're in the wrong place." And I said, "Oh, that's nothing unusual." and then he said, "You got to go to New York, where the mills are." I said, "New York? I know somebody in New York. My mother. I know me in New York. I grew up in New York. I'm a fucking New Yorker." What can I say? I grew up. But I lived in California, and I traveled around Europe. I lived in, I've had many lives. And I'd been in California for 18 years. I had two kids. Where they had me. I haven't figured that one out yet. And so I come to New York. I come stay with my mother. And we have this wonderful conversation because she comes from the textile in the world as well. She used to design, work for Oscar de la Renta and Ralph Lauren, making their first samples and stuff like that. But she also made the clothes for her sisters, which he had five of them. Anyway, so I'm making appointments with a bunch of the mills and with and trying to say, well, listen, I have this concept for a contract service where people can send their jeans in, the manufacturers, and we'll go out to a small town that's lost its industry that had a big plant, and they would love to be partners in a business. Mm. This way you have people who are excited about working. Because I was a contractor, and the key to contracting was to make a partner of your employees. Mm. So they're not your employees, they're your partner.
Yeah.
And you have, what we're trying to do today is create another environment in the social web.
Yeah.
You have people who are listening, listening specialists or VP of listening. Anyway, so to make the story, long story short, short story long.
Too late for that.
Too long. Right. Can't get this thing going because it's an interesting story.
Yeah.
So I go around to a bunch of the mills and I with my idea and I go to Burlington Industries and they say, "You're out of your mind. You're nuts. You're an artist. We don't do things like that." So I go to Cotton Incorporated, the Cotton Ball, which is on the most recognized logo outside of IBM at the time. It's the Cotton Balls. Mm-hmm. And it's on a lot of clothes. Anyway, I talked to this guy who is the senior VP of research. He's the man. He's responsible for more innovations. Well, let's put it this way. Someone said he walks on water in the textile industry. Now, Cotton Incorporated is not a private industry. It's funded by a dollar off of every bale of cotton at the time and was mandated by the U.S. government in the 1930s in order to help promote cotton in all aspects, not just the growing, but the manufacturing, the milling, the dyeing, and the cutting and sewing end of it and beyond. And they had offices here in New York. So I meet this guy who's from, he's actually German-born, a brilliant scientist. And we're taking a taxi, and I have him already signed to a non-disclosure agreement, because I knew a little bit about that. We're driving in a taxi, and he's looking at the square inch, and I'm telling him how I did it, which was a sandblasting derivation, and that I was a contractor, and so I knew this thing inside and out. And he looked at me, he said, "This will revolutionize the textile industry. Nobody in our industry could ever think about it doing it this way, because it's just an out of the box, out of the industry, out of your mind potential of looking at something from a perspective that you could never imagine if you were stuck in a rut."
at that point to create the wear, the worn feel, or the kind of broken in look on jeans? Were they already washing them with rocks?
They were washing them with rocks. They were putting Gerbeau and Guess, and I think they were related in some way. Guess Jean, the Marciano brothers. And what they were doing is they were putting pumice in washing machines. Now, the problem with that is that 5% of the jeans were destroyed and the machines were destroyed because of the pumice. And I brought them a way that they could do it in fabric form. And they were excited about that because the mills didn't have anything like that. And
so what would they do? Kind of hang the jeans up or put them on mannequin legs and rotate them in front of a sandblaster?
No. On their process, on their process, they would put it the finished garment after they made it,
okay,
and lose 5% of the garment.
Yeah.
On my process, they could do it in fabric form,
yeah,
on the roll, with a sandblasting derivation. It wasn't a sandblasting process.
Mm.
And so they built the largest Burlington Industries and Cotton Incorporated built the largest textile machine in the history of the textile industry.
Whoa, off the back of your idea?
Off the back of my idea. And it was, they had to raise the roof, and it was in...
You're always raising the roof.
The roof is raising me. It's just an illusion that we have of me raising. But what's interesting, though, is that I... here I am, this inventor, and then I have a couple of guys behind me. One's a lawyer, we file for a patent because I'm showing this. I don't have a patent, and I'm not realizing, a patent only gives you protection to defend yourself. And meanwhile, the patent officer, we had to wait for the patent officer $75,000 later to retire before the supervisor of the patent office had given us the. He called up my lawyer and he says, "I don't know why my examiner didn't give you a patent. I'm giving you a patent." What was also interesting is this patent was the largest patent office in the world, patent company who filed it, Lattice and Perry, and they had done Xerox. They held all the patents on Superman and they were excited because most patents, as most people don't know or do know, never get commercialized. Mine was commercialized before the patent was off. Given, whatever they call it, a patent. So that was an interesting thing. I learned a lot about patents, and I would never do a patent again.
Well, I'm imagining you never had to work again.
Oh, well, that was the dream. I was supposed to make more money in one month than my whole lifetime. So I started,
You were supposed to.
Right. And I was getting like $10,000 a month of royalty-free, royalties, but work-free. So I was commuting between New York and Paris, and, I said, God, what do you do with this kind of money when you have more money than you can put in, you can only put one spoonful in your mouth at a time. So I was trying to see, I had relatives in France, so I went to France, which is where I met the guys from Gerbeau and Guess, and the guy who actually invented, who had the idea of putting stones in a washing machine. We talked, and he was working for Gerbeau. What was interesting, though, was that Europe has a whole different mindset. So after we had the samples of the product, and I went to Premier Vision, which is the primary textile company, trade show in Europe. And I would go with the head of the denim division of Burlington Industries, who were my partners, who had an exclusive for a certain period of time for commercializing. And what happened was, I would talk to all the mills there. He would introduce me, and I'd say, well, his idea was this would be cheaper and faster to get to that sandstone washing effect. And they weren't interested in that. They said, when I came back a year later and I said, oh, well, I'm giving you the same spiel. They said, don't talk to me about that. I don't care about saving money or something. Give me something new.
Oh, wow.
Give me something interesting. Give me something that will, you know, they understood that. We in America look at the bottom line.
Yeah.
And so there is that.
So does nobody use that process anymore?
No, no. The, you know, the truth of the matter is I have a new improved version, which is a lot less expensive, but I'm not telling anybody. I don't want to get involved in that world again. Because what happens when you give birth to a baby and you give it to somebody else to bring up, they're going to bring it up differently than you.
Yeah.
And well, the big thing now is, you know, a lot of people talking raw denim. You know, the whole point is to create the patina in the trousers that you're in many ways living in. It's not everybody is into the concept of wearing a pair of jeans for 6 months and not washing them, so that occurs on the first wash. You get the kind of wear marks. But, you know, the innovation is coming in all different shapes and sizes. Hyatt Denim, for example, in Wales, is offering you a pair of, you know, $300 jeans if you'll wear them for 6 months for somebody else. Who
really?
Then gets them worn in? Yeah.
Really? Now
you put your name down.
Wow, thanks. Now, interesting here, what most people don't know is that, first of all, denim, it comes from the town of Denim in France, and where they had indigo. Now, denim is the miners used to, and Levi Strauss made it popular. How denim is made is it's dipped in indigo, a white thread, that's where you get the white, is dipped 8 times through a bath of indigo continuously. So it builds up a ring. So it's like, it's called ring dyed. These are all things I learned after the fact. I have no concept of what until I saw that. But the issue is that the ring dye is done with a starch. And that's why the jeans are so stiff. Is because of the starch. So now there are other ways of getting it softer, which is one is an enzyme, one is a brushing way, one is ways I probably can't even think about at the moment.
Being dragged behind a horse.
But now the early miners in the early days, what they would do is they would buy a pair of jeans and they would jump in a lake or a river, not salt water, and would... let the jeans fit their body because it would then
shrink to fit
on you. Now, one of the early issues was there was a rivet. It was a lot of rivets, and there was a rivet right next to your crotch. And so when you were sitting by a fire, that would get on fire. And you can let your imagination take it from there.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I won't be titling this audio Hot Crotch.
Oh, and you know what? Here we are filming it. We've got to press...
You've got your camera sat on a bag.
I don't have it on. It says standby.
So, luckily...
We have your audio.
My backup is recording.
I have no brains.
You were so excited to see me.
Yeah, I was.
I don't think it's worthless. You've got a copy right here. You can right-click the play button on Audio Boom and download it.
Yeah, sure.
Audio Boom, whatever it's called now.
Right. Yeah. So, but anyway, the interesting thing is, as an inventor, it's your mind. You have to train your mind to see the obvious that nobody else sees. Invention is the obvious that's right in front of your eyes, but you're looking for something much more complex.
Is this why in your writing and sometimes in your speaking and in your documentalism, you often contradict yourself in almost a surrealistic way? You know, I don't raise the roof raises me, it's an illusion. I didn't bring my children up, they brought me up. Is it a way of creating the mindset where you're always looking at things from another angle?
Right. It's part of a thing that I've trained myself over many years to look at myself and action and look at the world and turn it inside out and upside down. I was with a young...
Give me an example of other people that do this.
Well, anybody who's an inventor really thinks differently. And what they do is, and I was talking to two young guys, 18 and 19, on Sunday. And what was interesting is I was trying to explain to them how their mind works, because I can't memorize things. Since I can't memorize things, I have to get inside of things. And when you get inside of things, it's not like some people can go directly, because they can memorize things, they can go directly into things, you know, but they don't learn anything. They, you know, they're good at school, they get, you know, they know how to memorize, they get good grades, but they don't have original thought. They're not thinking outside the box. They're thinking in that same rut. And so for me, my thing out of kind of necessity was learning how my mind works, which is like many people's mind work, non-linearly. And so you pick up a picture book or you look down the street, you walk down and you see things completely from a, they're non-linear. You know, celluloid in film is linear. A book is not less linear. You can pick it up anywhere and read or look at pictures anywhere. Now, what's interesting in that kind of non-linear experience, which is why I'm really exploring what I call experiential storytelling, because I want to try and create environments that take you out of that spectator and put you into an experience. And that's challenging. You know, I have a film now. It's called A Conversation, a mythical documentary, A Conversation with Lucifer, a.k.a. Satan.
I've seen some of I've seen some of the workings of this in some of your behind-the-scenes back channel websites.
Right, right. And what the thing is, it's a film, but there's no images on the screen. Now, why is there no images on? Because you've never seen Lucifer. I've never seen Lucifer, and it's in the dark. So the concept, if it's in a theater, it would be in the dark.
Wow.
And there would be no lights. And it would be
a shared experience still.
Right.
As if everybody's in hell together.
Right.
But unless he's coming to the theatre.
Right, right.
To see himself.
Well, no,
you should definitely invite him.
Well, actually, I've told him I will kill him if he shows up, because he's supposedly... And he's playing himself, and then we decide...
So you're going through all the myths of Lucifer, or... Because you know, effectively a fallen angel, you know, he comes from the same roots as everybody else.
Right, right, right. Well, it's quite interesting how articulate he is, because I hypnotized him, was what our latest... I drugged him and hypnotized him.
Regressing Satan. There's another title in there.
But what's interesting with him is that he... he's able to talk in the first person, and he talks about his early clients, which were monkeys, and you know, and how he taught them, and how he likes.
Wow, you're bringing the evolutionary aspect into, because that's going back before the concept of Lucifer ever existed, obviously.
Right, right. Well actually, I said to him, what was Lucifer's relationship to God? Well, you know, before. And they were the best of buddies. They were buddies. They were, you know, he looked at him, he said, you know, do this. And he, you know, he was and I said to him, how did he pick you out as opposed to other people?
Are you doing this from a person with a religious perspective?
No, I even though I've got a documentary called Madness and God and another one on called Observing the Observant, this piece on a mythical conversation documentary on Lucifer is really kind of a play within the play.
But you don't go to church?
No. I go to the church of rain when it's
at
raining.
At the moment,
outside.
It is. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, some people don't feel the need to feel a connection or a spiritual connection. I don't know.
I think. It's interesting you're asking me this, because I'm doing a documentary on a guy who is spiritual, but he says he's a secular shaman. He's spiritual, but he's a devout atheist.
You've mentioned three documentaries in less than 3 minutes. Non-linear doesn't mean that you never finish it.
No, non-linear doesn't mean that I never finish, but it also means I never begin.
Okay.
So there is no beginning and end to a lot of my documentaries. There's a lot.
So really, all of your stuff should be hosted in a kind of a in a cross-platform, multi-channel playground where people can just flit from one concept
to
another.
Well, that's what I'm hoping that actually people do. I have a documentary, another one called Pondering the Imponderable with Howard Bloom, in which I now have...
Oh, I've seen a lot. You've got hours and hours of footage already.
And I just was with him and his family at a family reunion Sunday where I filmed 5 hours of him with his family.
He's good with this?
What?
He's okay with the...
Sure.
Does he ever say, don't put that in?
No. Oh, yes, once.
Oh, what was it?
I can't mention. He'll kill me.
Okay.
But I will say that I'm doing a film around... I have half of it. I need to do some more. It's called The Devil or Angel... conversation about Michael Jackson.
Whoa. So would you consider open sourcing Creative Commonsing, should I say, all of your content later on so that people had the freedom to actually mash it up themselves?
Sure. No problem. At the moment, since
I'm alive.
Since I'm alive, or I ain't dead yet, is that what I tell people. I'm more... seeing if I can get this to another level before I open source it.
Yeah.
You know,
well, there is the possibility of a publisher or somebody setting through that could maybe organize and package smaller chunks in order for you to maybe be able to afford to live.
Well, that I've given up a long time ago. that's a luxury I haven't been able to do for a while. Being a risk taker, you have a lot of challenges. And sometimes you run with your shoes tied together, and sometimes the world makes you run with your shoes tied together because you have to be a certain stubbornness, arrogance, asshole to live your life. And sometimes that is really about being you in the face of everything else, and that has challenges, and you have to take those challenges on in ways that you can never imagine. I mean, I never imagined I'd be standing here with His Honorable documentally.
Well, it's our paths cross very occasionally, but it's wonderful when they do.
Right.
We should leave it there because I'm on my phone. I have no idea how long the batteries might last, so we can record more offline for later consumption and collaborative working later.
Right. Well,
where can people find you online?
I'm kind of putting my meanderings on geogeller.com. That's geogeller.com.
And recently you started planting some seeds on SoundCloud /geo_geller. G-E-L-L-E-R.
Is it a hyphen?
It might be one of the two. But if they search geogeller, they'll find two accounts. One of them's got more stuff on.
Right. Well, it's all delusional.
You're old enough to be using underscores in stuff.
Yeah, I am old enough.
Old school.
You might be right. I've been underscored.
You're pre-web, aren't you?
Yeah. I started using computers in 84. And I'm always interested in the vocabularies. When I first saw the web, it wasn't even the web. In about 87, I saw CompUSA and... And I said to my, I think it was $1 a minute. And I said to myself, who the fuck can afford this? But the other thing is, I'm always interested in palettes and vocabularies. And that's what the social web really is. It's a new vocabulary. And the internet is really a social web. We just don't recognize it. We think of it in terms of technology rather than in terms of humanity. And it's not the people... It's not the technology that changes society, it's the people who use it and how they use it. There have been lots of different things out there that are been available, but for some reason or not, like the audio industry is known that combustible engine, gas-driven engines have been inefficient, but they're married to it.
Definitely.
Think about that. They're married to the path. And that's the interesting thing about the legacy companies, as we started talking about, you were talking about, you looked at the bandwidth in at the web and in your hotel.
Yeah, I mean, here we've got 3 megabytes symmetrical, but that's capped, obviously, because they want to charge you still for the internet. You know, you're talking about $1 a minute. If they could go back there, they'd be more than happy to. Whereas at the moment, people at the web are enjoying 700 megabytes at least. I think that was the wired connection, but 700 meg symmetrical is quite a nice speed. You could probably send yourself down the pipes.
Yeah, I've been working on that. I'm sending it to you, actually.
Anyway,
Gio. We shall continue.
Yeah, we shall continue.
And let me give you a hug.
Is a hug in audio.
All right.
Don't cross the beards.
Okay.